facts or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power at Grantham University. Now here's your host, Jason Forticola.
Today we'll be joined by OurFuture.org Executive Editor Isaiah Poole and AFGE Local 1843 leaders Ramona Sears, Betty Conlin, Linda James, and Kelvin Flannery. First up, we have Isaiah Poole, the Executive Editor of OurFuture.org. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
So the Campaign for America's Future is hosting the Summit on Jobs and America's Future this month. Tell us about the event.
The Summit on Jobs and America's Future is an effort to bring labor, progressive activists, members of Congress together to forge a national movement for an aggressive, robust jobs program, something that is much more aggressive and much more forceful than what we're seeing coming out of the Congress right now.
And who's going to be participating in this event?
We have the president of the AFL-CIO is going to be one of our keynote speakers. We have members of Congress, Keith Ellison and George Miller on board. Los Angeles Mayor Villagrosa is on board. So we have a number of other people who are economists, activists, youth activists, labor activists, think tank leaders, all involved in this.
And you mentioned participants from the youth sector and labor. Talk about how important those two groups are in really furthering this agenda.
Well, they're both extraordinary. Youth are really suffering the brunt of this recession. I mean, the unemployment rate among college graduates is extraordinarily high. We cannot afford to have a situation where we have college graduates unable to get jobs. If you're talking about President Obama's ambition to have a nation that outcompetes, that outsmarts the rest of the world, the situation we have now where we have college students burdened down with debt and can't do better than a job at a fast food restaurant. That is absolutely intolerable. It's a national disgrace. We need to get a handle on that. The interesting thing about what's happening with the labor movement and with young people is look at Wisconsin. Look at that state capital there. A lot of what's driving that movement is young people, college students, who see the connection between their struggle and the overall labor struggle. So and we're happy to sort of bring that together and create some additional energy around that.
And you touched on a key point. It's not enough to just create jobs for our young people and for everyone, but they have to be good jobs. Right.
Well, they absolutely have to be good jobs. And, you know, one of the there have been a couple of studies recently that show that even with the Obama recovery plan, what we saw in terms of job creation in 2009 and in 2010 were jobs that earned significantly less than the jobs that were lost during the Great Recession. The way to that, what we have to do, and the reason why we're bringing this job summit together is to talk about having a jobs program that actually creates the kinds of jobs that we need in order to rebuild the country, rebuild the economy, and rebuild the middle class.
And what are some examples of those types of jobs?
For example, we have a construction industry that's literally on its back right now. And we have millions of miles of decaying roads and bridges. And we have record low interest rates. That is a perfect positive storm to have a major infrastructure program that uses public dollars to leverage private dollars to create construction jobs right now on everything from new highways to mass transit to high-speed rail, all of the things that we need to have an efficient transportation network to build the economy on. And it's not just transportation, by the way. It's also energy. Yeah, it's also home and office reconstruction, all of those things that we need.
And in addition to construction types jobs, it would probably be fair to assume that those projects would also lead to opportunities in engineering and things like
that. It's engineering, it's manufacturing. I mean, the other thing that we've got to do is really rebuild our manufacturing base. And the public sector, this whole line that the government does not create jobs, of course it does. And it's not just the jobs in which you're directly on the government payroll, but through the investments and through the policy decisions that government makes, we can either energize the industrial sector by saying, for example, that our procurement is focused on goods that are made in America, that we have an industrial policy which says that we will do the kind of research and development that produced the internet, and that we will do that for a new wave of innovation that then the private sector can use and build upon. We can make those kinds of decisions to make a whole spectrum of jobs.
Now, we hear a lot in the press about the need for high-speed rail. How soon, how quickly do you think we can be a nation that gets to that point?
If we had done this when we started talking about this 20 years ago, we'd be on pace with China and some of the European countries, such as Germany, that have solid high-speed rail networks. So the technology is there now. I love the Acela, but even the Acela only goes about 125 miles an hour. If we had really put the money into reinforcing that, sort of really rebuilding that rail network that connects Washington to Boston, we could have done that so that we would not just run 125 mile an hour trains. We could run 250 mile an hour trains and do that Washington to Boston run in about 4 hours instead of the 6 or so hours it takes now.
And if, like you said, we know that the technology is there in terms of the ability to do it. If you could put your finger on one thing, what is the holdup?
The holdup is conservatives in both Congress and in some state capitals who somehow have this allergy to the notion of a public good, of the need for public of investment, of the critical need, in fact, for public investment. They don't recognize that the reason why our tails are being beaten in other countries around the world is precisely because those countries do have a public investment mentality. The Chinese government makes strategic investments in its industries and in its infrastructure. And that is why their economy is moving so fast.
And sure, at some point, the need for a solid public infrastructure must be realized in order to stay competitive globally, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If we can't move, we cannot move people and goods efficiently today. The Texas Transportation Institute does an annual study of traffic. And listeners to your sister station, WTOP, they hear the traffic reports every morning. And so they know how much time we spend just stuck in traffic.
That's a great point.
Which is money, by the way.
There was a very nice write-up a couple of months ago, I believe, in the Wall Street Journal about Washingtonians spending more time in traffic every year than any other city in the country. That can't be productive.
It is not productive. It means that businesses lose productivity, and families lose that time that they could be spent with their children. It's an incredible drain. It's an incredible drain on our energy resources as well.
Let's talk about the revival of the American economy, which is one of the objectives of the job summit that's upcoming. What's the key factor in reviving America's economy right now?
You know, that is that question. I don't know if it's one key, but I think it's actually several things that we need to be doing simultaneously. We need to, first of all, I think, recognize that we do have to catch up. Our problem is not, as it's been too often defined here in Washington, that we are spending too much money. It may be true that in some cases we're not spending it wisely. But it's not that we're not spending enough money. It is that, in fact, or that we're spending too much money. It is, in fact, that we're not spending enough money in the right ways to jumpstart the economy. So that is the first hurdle we need to get past. We need to get into the mindset that the number one priority is putting people to the work. And if you are concerned about deficits, get people paying money back into the tax system. Get people into $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year jobs. That is going to go a long way toward repairing the economy. And you're not going to be able to do it by taking your hands off the steering wheel and expect that the private sector will just do it alone. We've got $2 trillion of capital just sort of sitting in the sidelines right now, in part because there is not an ethos in the business community that says we ought to take that money and actually spend it on people. And we got to break that.
And some people on the other side would say that the deficit needs to come down first and foremost. And you're saying that we need to create jobs to get people back to work, to generate some tax revenues to help tackle that deficit.
And on that point, Mark Zandi, who used to be John McCain's economic advisor, one of his economic advisors, said that the cuts that are being contemplated by the House would cost us 700,000 jobs. And even Ben Bernanke, who disputed that number, agreed that the cuts that are being proposed by the House will slow the economy. Now, I think he, and in fact, John Boehner, Speaker of the House, when confronted with the loss of federal jobs, said, so be it.
And so my question to you is then, getting people back to work first, how long can the country go running the deficit that it's running? When should that be addressed and how quickly?
I would say that if we got ourselves down from 9% unemployment to something closer to 6% unemployment, we can begin to then work also on addressing some of the deficit issues that we've got a bit more aggressively. And frankly, if we look at that whole area of corporate welfare, which is currently not on the table politically, the subsidies to agribusiness, to the oil and gas companies, there's a whole spectrum of stuff in that area that even the deficit commission said that we should be doing. And there's no reason why we can't start doing that now, actually.
Now, as you know, the House has passed a budget proposal that would avert a government shutdown, and I believe there were about $4 billion in cuts. What is your reaction to averting the government shutdown, albeit only for about 2 weeks?
Here's my concern. The $4 billion that were cuts, a lot of that were things that the Obama administration were interested in cutting anyway, and in fact, may well deserve to be off the table. I haven't seen the entire list, but certainly even the General Accounting Office just this week issued a report saying that there are a lot of duplicative federal programs. Nobody's making an argument that government should spend money inefficiently. So we are willing to offer ideas and suggestions and all of that to say that here are some areas where government could tighten up its act. My concern, though, is that we may be falling right into the hands of these, what I call, so be it conservatives. If you keep on stringing this fight out for 2 week in time frames, okay, you're going to get $4 billion, we'll give you 2 weeks, and then we'll cut another $4 billion for another 2 weeks. And then we're doing the same destruction, and in fact doing it in a worse way. And I have a real concern about that.
Isaiah Poole, executive editor of OurFuture.org. We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're back with Isaiah Poole, the executive editor of OurFuture.org, talking about the impact of a government shutdown. And I think one of the things that gets overlooked quite a bit is the impact on Americans' services, the impact on the public. So often we're just bombarded with numbers and dollars and cents and finances and cut this and cut here, but no one really talks about the impact that it would have on the American public.
There's also something really unfortunate in the nomenclature that we're using around this. There is a classification of essential government employees and non-essential government employees. And I heard on a cable talk show some chatter, which was in effect, well, if we're letting non-essential government employees, telling them not to come to work for a few days, isn't that a good thing? No, it's not, actually. Because these so-called non-essential government employees are the people who make sure that your Social Security checks get in your mailbox. These are the people who make sure that, all of the things that we associate with government service, happen. There isn't really such a thing as a non-essential government employee. So I wish that we had a different way to refer to the two different classes of employees that we're dealing with here.
And adding fuel to the fire in this conversation is this assault on collective bargaining rights for public employees. Now, we're seeing that obviously in Wisconsin and some other states. Talk about that for a little bit.
Well, first of all, we have had a 20 or to 30 year imbalance in the power dynamic between workers and employers and corporations. And the result of that in the private sector has been stagnant wages for average workers and exorbitantly high wealth being moved upward to CEOs and top executives. And the fruits of improved productivity, et cetera, are not going to the workers who created that productivity, but it's going to the very top. In the public sector, at least, there's been some success in maintaining more of a balance between what the workers should be entitled to And what the government is entitled to, or any public agency is entitled to, in terms of a productive workforce that does its job. Upsetting that balance in the public sector is not a wise thing to do. Number one, because we want good, energized, involved people working in the, people who care about their jobs. We don't want people who are demoralized, who are beaten down, who feel that they have no stake in their workplace. I think that's extraordinarily destructive to the idea of good government.
And talk about the need for strong collective bargaining rights in the federal workplace.
If you don't, I mean, for one thing, there has to be a culture in which workers are respected, the work that they do is respected and understood, that the missions are clear and cannot be manipulated by the whims of political, by political winds or other things. You know, the idea of an independent civil service is, incredibly valuable. And in the last administration, where we saw an erosion of the notion of an independent civil service that was an objective check on the abuses of the political establishment. We saw that erosion, and it had some very negative effects. You know, we saw that in the Justice Department in terms of things like civil rights enforcement, for example. We've saw it in a number of other agencies where the policy people tried to inappropriately manipulate the sort of the day-to-day administrative processes of government for partisan political ends. And one of the things that collective bargaining does is to put a brake on that.
Do you see this situation in state capitals around the country, in Wisconsin and Indiana and Ohio, as a defining moment for the labor movement to keep what they've worked so hard to achieve?
It is absolutely a defining moment. We've gotten, for the first time in a long time, the country's attention on what the importance of the labor movement, and it's a time for labor to make the argument about why it's important to have a strong workers' rights movement that in which workers can, in fact, balance the scales in talking to management, whether that management is public or private.
And we talked a little bit before we went on the air, and you made a great point and said this isn't just an assault on collective bargaining rights. This is an assault on the entire middle class.
Here's why. Go back to the point I made earlier about stagnant wages. There's no accident, I think, that we've had a period in which wages for people who are living in the bottom 40% of the economy have stagnated or have gone down, at the same time that union participation in the private sector is now down to about 7%. When we had a robust labor movement, we also had robust wages, robust wage growth in the middle class. And that contributed to an overall sense of well-being and overall economic growth. Now, labor made some bad calls from time to time, but so did management. And so it's not fair to say, well, the reason why we have all the economic ills that we have now is because of labor. No. Both sides are culpable. Both sides have to learn from the mistakes that they've made. Both sides have to adjust to new global economic realities. So the thing to do is not to say, oh, we don't need a labor movement anymore, and leave everything, all of the power, in the hands of management and political bosses.
And politicians in Washington and elsewhere have suggested that a way to balance the budget is on the backs of the public workers, on the middle class. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's insidious. In Wisconsin, Before Governor Walker launched his assault on collective bargaining, he gave away billions of dollars in tax breaks to Wisconsin businesses. And so what you really have is a very direct connection between the fact that corporations were offered a reduction in taxes, and then at the same time, teachers, firefighters, well, not the firefighters specifically, but teachers and other public employees who are making $40,000 or $50,000, $60,000 a year were asked to give up the equivalent of about $8,000 a year. Take home $8,000 less to feed their families and to house their children. So if I'm a CEO, I get a tax break. If I'm a teacher, I get a cut in pay. What's the fairness in that?
It begs a very important question.
If you want shared sacrifice, then let's talk about shared sacrifice. I would want to know what Governor Walker would want the top earners in Wisconsin to give up.
And as we looked at the numbers when President Obama's two-year pay freeze was handed down, the actual savings or what it would bring off of the deficit was such a small percentage, yet every person, every federal employee would be negatively impacted, obviously bringing in less money, like you said, to their families.
Well, exactly. It's certainly not a way to stimulate the economy. It's not a particularly effective way to bring down the federal deficit. We really cannot address this deficit problem without looking at all of the corporate welfare, all of the giveaways that we give to the rich. Why do I need a mortgage deduction on my vacation home? Why do I need that?
But instead, things are being discussed about impacts to Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Those are the things that you hear in the news. And those type of cuts would also have very real impacts on middle-class Americans.
Well, let's talk about something that you don't hear about every day. Let's talk about something called the Community Development Block Grant Program. That is a program that pays for a variety of services. One, I heard from one woman last week, for example, who runs a shelter for battered women. And part of the funding for that shelter comes through a community development block grant. The House Republicans have cut community development block grants by about 60 or 70%. What that may mean is that that particular shelter for battered women, and battered women can be of all classes, that particular shelter may not get its funding. We'll have to let people go, may have to close. Speaker John Boehner talked about the morality of getting the budget and getting spending under control. But I think suggesting that the way to do that is to close a battered women's shelter is immoral.
And so what kind of ways do you think that people can push back against that to send a strong message to Washington that those aren't the types of cuts that should be made?
Well, there are a number of things that are happening around the country. I mean, we have our job summit, which is happening March 10th at the National Press Club. But there are a number of things that are happening. There's this movement called U.S. Uncut. And U.S. Uncut is one of a number of grassroots efforts to stage protests and to basically take a stand. It enables people, if you happen to be a beneficiary of some of these programs, if you happen to know what Head Start means for your child, for example, if you happen to know what has been done through some of these block grant programs that are being cut, it's a way for you to register that support for keeping those programs intact.
We're coming down into our last minute here, but I want to get your thoughts on one last subject. You wrote a fabulous article recently on the myth that public employees are overpaid. And I want you to talk about that for a minute if you can, because when you look at the numbers objectively, it simply is not the case.
And there was an article in USA Today that was really aggravating because it does something that Wall Street Journal did the same thing about a week or so ago. They lump in, if you take the public employee workforce, it includes everybody from the guy making minimum wage at McDonald's on up to, you know, the head of ExxonMobil. Okay, so you average that out and you get a number. Public employees, you don't have a lot of people who are flipping burgers, okay? It's an educated workforce, a highly skilled workforce. It's apples and oranges. So those comparisons, what you have to do is compare apples to apples. And when you compare apples to apples, public sector work generally pays less.
Bottom line.
Bottom line.
And so what can we do to change that perception? I guess more articles like yours need to be written, right?
More articles like mine need to be written, but I think we need to push back against the misperceptions in the media. Push back aggressively.
Isaiah Poole, executive editor of OurFuture.org, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Some polls say Americans don't trust government, but listen to our members, the real people who work hard for you every day.
I'm Mike Schnobrick, a correctional officer at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. Trust me, the terrorists are locked down tight.
My name is Janet Winghart, a Social Security claims rep in Fort Lauderdale. Senior citizens can trust me to get them the right check at the right time.
I'm Michelle Reed, a registered nurse at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. Trust me, I care for our veterans like family.
My name is Everett Kelly. I work for the Anniston Army Depot, Anniston, Alabama. Trust me, our tanks are tough.
I'm John Gage, president of AFGE. You can trust us. We work for you. Brought to you by AFGE and online at afge.org.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by three representatives from AFGE's VA Local 1843. We've got Linda James, the treasurer, Ramona Sears, the president, and Betty Conlon, the vice president. Ladies, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So you are stationed at the Northport Veterans Hospital in Long Island, New York, facing some situations there related to hiring veterans. Is that right?
Yes.
Why don't you start by telling me the scene?
Well, veterans are coming in looking for jobs, and they're service-connected, and they're not getting jobs there. Or they're related to two jobs, either a housekeeper or in the kitchen, and they don't seem to want to give them anything else. They hire other people from college or whatever, and the veterans who served our country, who they're supposed to be hiring, don't seem to be getting hired there.
And you have some personal experience with this, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Why don't you tell us about that?
My son came back from serving in Iraq, and he applied for a job, and apparently they lost the application. And when I questioned them, they said it was too late, and then I confronted them again, and they let him put in another application, and then it took forever to get it. And then he went for an interview, and he scored very, very high in the interview, but he didn't get the job.
Did he ever get a reason why he didn't get the job?
No. My son called and spoke to people in HR. I mean, left messages, and they never got back to him.
And my assumption is that you, being a representative of the local, probably discussed this with your local president. And how did that go?
Well, they want us to follow through, but it doesn't seem to work. It's very hard. Some people at Northport Hill are helpful. Other ones are not.
One of the things I'd like to mention is that the person that was in charge of all this fiasco is no longer chief of human resources. So I would say that we had a hand somewhat in that.
And do you think that the policies in place that were in place at the time have been changed? Can you do you feel confident about that?
Well, we have to make sure we stay on top of it, which is what we're doing.
Okay. And in what ways are you going about doing that?
Well, as soon as we hear something, we inquire as to what's going on. We know the people to who to contact, and we do that. My problem that I'm having with Northport right now is that they are letting people go because they're saying that we need so many, we have too many FTEs, so we have to lose 50. So where are they losing that? I work in the laboratory as a medical technologist, and we are understaffed. Now, if you don't have people to do the work of these people that are coming in, you know, they have to have lab work done. We have long lines out there, and the patients get very upset.
It sounds like this is a situation where numbers are trying to be met without really considering the impact on the work, on the employees, and the service that's provided.
Absolutely. To the veterans, that's right.
But we're top-heavy. A lot of management.
And how does that resonate with the rest of the workforce? Do your colleagues, do they sense that? Do they see that there are a lot of people in management, yet the workers are being let go or positions not being filled?
Absolutely. The morale is horrible.
It's horrific there. Morale is very low.
And are you doing some things within the local to try to bring up morale so that people feel a little bit better about themselves at the workplace?
We're trying our best to get as many people to understand what's going on. But what you have is complacency. And when we have our meetings, we give the information out, and we wanted to get a bus here. We had a hard time getting 8 people to sign up for the bus.
They're afraid.
Is there a lot of pushback from management or intimidation?
No. I think it's the mindset. It's the old mindset of the employees as to how Northport works. I have to say that we have a pretty decent director, and he does work with us. But his hands are tied, too, because he's been told, I got to get rid of 50 people. Where am I getting rid of them from?
And so where's that directive coming from?
The vision. I think we're vision 3. I'm not sure.
Yes, we are.
And so while you're dealing with these issues, what other things are you working on in 1843?
Well, we just found out now that some of the new employees are coming in. We're told that they automatically become permanent, and we have other ones that have been there for a year and a half, 2 years, 2.5 years, that are still temporary, and we can't get an answer why.
That doesn't seem to make sense. What about the reaction of the part-time employees who are seeking full-time work?
They're getting the runaround. They ask management, and they're not being told anything.
And so how do you respond to that as leaders of your local?
As far as the union is concerned, you know, the person has to come to us and make a complaint. If we don't get a complaint, we can't look into it. And some of these people, the majority of them, are afraid to come to the union office and make a complaint because of their supervisor. Usually it's not the service chief that's the problem. It's the midline supervisor who's like a dinosaur from the old days. Who's new to the system and doesn't want to work with us.
And people have to realize that if it was not for our veterans, there would be no jobs. Thanks to them, we have the jobs, and they should be 100% priority.
How do the veterans that you see in Northport, how do they respond to the care that they're getting and the dedication that you're providing them?
We're providing them with good care. Don't misunderstand that. Our people, even though they're working short and working long hours, are doing a fantastic job. I have to say that everybody that works in Northport is giving their best to these veterans, because we are a veterans hospital and they take top priority.
And we have top ratings with our patients. They absolutely love the work we do with them.
So you're understaffed, yet you're still not just meeting your requirements, but exceeding them. You're being judged on a very high level by your peers, your superiors. What does something like a pay freeze do to a staffing situation that's already low and the morale is low?
I don't think they realize that we don't make the money that they think we make. And we have families, and living on Long Island is absolutely horrible. The taxes are killing us, and school taxes and everything else. It's very hard to live. And to put a pay freeze on our pay is ridiculous. We just can't afford it.
I kind of feel that it hasn't really hit home to some of these people yet, because they thought that this wasn't going to happen. It was just words in the wind. But now they're finding out that this is a reality, and we did get a pay freeze.
And they're starting to feel that in their paychecks.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So what are your objectives when you go to Capitol Hill this week to meet with your legislators?
To scream as loud as we can.
And what will you be screaming about?
Unity in the community.
That sounds like a nice slogan. Tell me about that.
Well, what it means is that we're all together, and we're not supposed to look at it as
individuals.
We're all unions, all people that have a job, that are working. We're all on the same page.
And we need to unite.
And we have to unite.
Everyone's in this
State
together.
And
we're in this together.
All need to unite.
So we know that 2010 was a great year overall for the VA. You had a very nice nationwide organizing blitz. You saw an increase in membership. How does that impact what you do when you go to Capitol Hill and you're talking to your legislators, knowing that you've got even more people behind you than you had in the past?
Well, I hope they realize that, you know, elections are coming up. Some of them just got elected, unfortunately the wrong ones, but we have to maintain that we are here to represent the veterans, this hospital, the employees, and to make sure that our voice is heard.
Linda, Ramona, and Betty, we'll give you the last word.
Well, I just want everything to work where everybody is happy and they treat our veterans the way they're supposed to be treated. And with that, that means they need to hire the people to take care of them, which they're not doing.
One of the problems I have is that the veterans that are coming back that have PTSD, they don't have enough social workers to take care of them. And that's one of my first concerns, knowing that that particular department is deficient in psychologists. These people need something.
I'm just hoping that the veterans' health care won't be compromised due to all these cuts, because I'm a veteran,
yes,
and I'm hoping that they keep us in their minds up front and foremost.
Well, we certainly thank you for your service and all of the work that you fine ladies are doing. Please keep it up.
Thank you very much.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab, or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Calvin Flannery, Chief Steward of AFGE Local 1843 in Northport, Long Island, New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about what you're doing here this week at AFGE's Legislative Conference.
We're basically organizing to address the situation in Washington that's occurring this year with the pay freezes, the changing of policies and benefits that we've had for years and years. We feel that it's a situation where they're using federal employees as a scapegoat for all the budget woes in this country.
You mentioned adjusting to some of the new policies and benefits. What are some of those?
Your retirement is usually based on the high three of your salary. They want to change that to a high five. So in other words, if you have a job that, you know, pays you a decent salary, I wouldn't say a fantastic salary, but a decent salary, you would have to work at that job for 5 years to have that considered as part of your retirement.
And how is that impacting workers today?
Well, you do have a bunch of workers that already have the high three in. And if this goes through the Congress and the Senate and this is changed, you will have people retiring and you're going to be losing the people who have the know-how and the capability of doing their job more efficiently because these people have been working for federal government for quite some time.
And how will that, Calvin, impact the workplace where you are in Northport?
The way it would impact it is you don't have that source anymore. You don't have the source of somebody who has the knowledge, the experience, and the know-how on how to address certain situations that come up on a daily basis in your workplace.
And I would assume that, coupled with a pay freeze, which isn't a very good recruiting method for new employees, that could cause a problem if you're losing that source of information but really unable to replace it with somebody else.
Well, I work at the VA, and the whole thing is they've always pushed to get the youngest and the brightest. If you have a pay freeze, these people are just going to use their government employee as a stepping stone to go to private hospitals or other hospital organizations and using that I worked for the government as a playing card for them to be hired. So we're training people, and then within 2 to 3 years, these people are out the door because they go elsewhere for a much higher salary and a much better benefit package than the VA or federal government offers you. This fallacy that we have this golden umbrella for benefits and retirement is just that, it's a fallacy.
And we know that at the Northport Veterans Hospital, you all provide top quality care. Eventually, are you concerned that services could slip because of people leaving, that source of information leaving, being understaffed and underfunded? Do you eventually think that could catch up with the hospital and impact patient care?
I have been in the healthcare field for 30 years. We are not making car parts. We're not on an assembly line. We're dealing with human beings. Each situation, it's particular to that person. We start downsizing. We start taking away the people who have the knowledge and the experience. Patient care is going to suffer. No two ways about it. 3 years ago, everybody was singing the praises of the VA and the way we restructured the department, that we were being used as a benchmark for other healthcare facilities, which include a lot of hospitals that they collectively combined as the way to do it. Now it's like, oh, do more with less, and I don't understand this. We got a war going on here, and you want to cut the VA budget? It doesn't make any sense to me. Like I said, we're not making car parts here. It's not, we don't work at McDonald's, get that number and serve it and move on. No. We definitely make sure that we do the best we can for our veterans.
And you're also not making millions of dollars. So with a pay freeze, that obviously is going to impact your workforce, right?
Let me enlighten a lot of people that don't understand the way the federal government pays. USA Today put out an article about a month ago saying that the average federal salary was $120,000 a year. I've been at the VA for 28 years. I'm not even close to $70,000. So I don't know where they're getting their figures from. But there's no way that the majority of federal employees are making that kind of money. And with the freeze on your salary, they haven't freezed the percentage that we have to pay for our health care. So we're working at a deficit. And this has been going on for about 7 years that we get what they call a cost of living increase. The percentage is much lower than the increase on your health care. So you're working at a deficit at that point. And this is for the last 7 years. So you're making less every year instead of making more.
So as the chief steward of your local, how do things like the pay freeze, the attitude of doing more with less, what are you hearing from your members about this? What are they coming to you and saying?
They're very upset because they feel like they're in a closet at this point. They don't know what's coming down the pike next. All these suggestions are coming out of Washington saying, oh, well, maybe we'll freeze this. Maybe we'll make it a high five instead of a high three. You're going to have to pay more for your health insurance. These things scare people because these are people who have worked for the federal government for quite a period of time. And now you're going to have people retiring when they don't want to because now they have to go find another job in another health care facility.
And what are you doing to stand up for these workers?
Before we showed up in Washington, I've been saying this since the freeze was proposed by President Obama, that we need to get the word out because this is the basic problem here. Everybody who works for the federal government knows what we get, knows what our salaries are, knows how much we pay for our health insurance. The people in the private sector are being fed all these lies about we've got this golden umbrella. We need to educate the private sector that we're all in the same boat here. I don't understand where these figures and how this is going to solve a deficit problem. How is this going? What programs do you really want to cut? Show us how to cut programs where it's not going to impact the services that we're supposed to be supplying to the general public. And if it makes sense, let's work it out. Get us involved in it. We can solve problems together.
Is that the message that you're taking up to Capitol Hill this week at AFGE's legislative conference?
Yes. I am very, very upset with the way that D.C. government is handling these departments. I'm talking about food and drug. I'm talking about air quality. People don't understand. They hear a soundbite, and they say, yeah, that sounds good to me. If you didn't have these programs and these services, you would be in very bad shape. I want to suggest that everybody that's listening to this, to either watch the movie or read the book, The Grapes of Wrath. That shows what happens when you don't have any kind of organized labor supporting the employees and the working people of this country.
Calvin Flannery, Chief Steward of AFGE Local 1843, thank you for your time.
Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you to our guests this week, OurFuture.org Executive Editor Isaiah Poole, and AFGE Local 1843 leaders Ramona Sears, Betty Conlin, Linda James, and Kelvin Flannery. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and Grantham University.